This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
The Humanist Network News.
It's May 27th, and you're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the American Humanist Association. I'm your host, Jess Constantine, podcasting from the Stephen Yule Imagine No Superstition studio in Albany, New York. Well, listeners, first I'd like to say thank you so much for bearing with the Humanist Network News podcast over our 5 or 6 month period of transition. As some of you may know from reading in our e-zine, the Institute for Humanist Studies podcast, e-zine, and a couple other programs are now officially being run by the American Humanist Association. So that means that myself, our development staff, Nancy Buxton, as well as our e-zine editor, Ruth Geller, are now officially employees of the American Humanist Association. And what that means for you is that there will be some changes to the e-zine and to the podcast, both as far as content and, you know, the look and feel of our programs, but also the technical pieces of it. And I'll give you more information about that towards the end of the show. But first, I want to actually introduce our new organization, our new HNN family to you. So here is American Humanist Association Executive Director Roy Speckhart sharing his thoughts on this new partnership.
I'm really excited about the future of the American Humanist Association and the entire humanist movement. I feel that with the podcast that we're doing, with the work that Humanist Network News has had going for years now, we're integrating that and bringing it to more people around the country.
Last week, I got to travel down to Washington, D.C., where the American Humanist Association is headquartered, and I interviewed all of the new staff, all of my new coworkers, about, you know, what they do and how they got involved in humanism and things like that. And I'm going to play that for you. But first, I thought it was time for you all to meet your new co-host. So the first clip that I'm going to play is my interview with Jenda Huang, who is the new HNN co-host.
Welcome, and thank you so much for stepping up to the challenge of co-hosting the Humanist Network News podcast with myself.
No, thank you. I'm glad I have this opportunity to do this. I mean, you know, I've listened to the podcast over time. I've always known about the really good work that IHS has done, so I'm really excited that, you know, the AHA can now be a part of the podcast and the e-zine and kind of, you know, move things forward and kind of build off of what you and Duncan have already created.
So tell us, obviously you'll be co-hosting the show with me. What else do you do for the American Humanist Association?
I am the programs manager here, and it's basically a behind-the-scenes job. We have like a calendar that I keep track of with all of our internal events and like when things have to go to a printer, when things need to be taken care of, or kind of deadlines that we have. And basically I try and make sure that the office runs smoothly, all, you know, just all in the background, in order so that the programs that the AHA offers, from like the chapters and the celebrants to development work to publishing the magazine and our newsletter and now stuff with the e-zine and, you know, the podcast and everything, to make sure that all that stuff stays on schedule.
That's pretty awesome. So you're sort of like, you're sort of the utility infielder of the American Humanist Association, sounds like.
Yeah, a little bit. Just got to make sure that everything keeps moving forward. And, you know, and of course, but then, you know, the downside of that, if something stops or something screws up, then it's kind of my fault too, because I should have been on top of it. So
you heard it, listeners. If anything goes wrong with the podcast, it's Jenda's fault. So, and I understand that you've been working with the organization for quite some time and at various stages in your life. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I've been with the AHA on and off for a really long time. When I graduated from the University of Minnesota back in 2002, I got an internship with the AHA. I was at a conference of the Secular Student Alliance, and I met another staff person, an AHA staff person there. And we just started talking, and then, you know, then she told me about the possibility of having an internship here. So I took that chance, and I started, I spent a summer doing field work, and then I was lucky enough that the AHA wanted to keep me on, and I really wanted to work for the AHA. So, you know, I did field work for 3 years, and
you say field work, what does that mean?
That was working with like our chapters and affiliates. I think when I started at the AHA, there were maybe 70 chapters and affiliates. And when I left, there was like a little over 100. So it was just working with those local groups, talking with the local leaders, making sure that all the groups had what they need, working on creating a grassroots manual for them. The AHA, you know, definitely, you know, 5 or 6 years ago was a lot smaller than it is now. And they never had someone at that time who could purely be devoted to doing field work. So I was kind of the first person who'd ever done that and was able to really focus on trying to just get new chapters and affiliates going. And, you know, I did what I could to support the already existing ones to make them stronger than they already were.
So you mentioned after graduating from college in Minnesota, which, by the way, is where Prince is from. Did you know that?
Oh, yeah. No, Prince, he's around.
So I just wanted to know, what's your background? Did you already know that you were a humanist or a free thinker?
Definitely by college, I was involved with my campus group there, the University of Minnesota Atheists and Humanists, which has now been renamed CASH, the Campus Atheists and Secular Humanists. But they're one of the, they might be the oldest humanist, like campus atheist humanist group in existence. But I was actually raised Roman Catholic and I was baptized and confirmed and all that. But definitely during high school, I had doubts, and I had a good friend of mine who was kind of coming into his Christianity at that time. So we spent a lot of lunches screaming at each other across the table about evolution and other kind of issues like that. And that really solidified my desire to read more and learn more about issues related to like science and then kind of, atheism and like belief and lack of belief and whatnot. So during high school, during that same time that I was being confirmed, I actually really realized that I lacked that belief in God. And
right. So,
I didn't know, when I went to college, I actually had no idea, like, would I be able to find a group? Would I not? And fortunately I was able to find a group. UMA, as it was called at the time, was already established and doing events. So I joined and I was part of it for all 4 years. And I was an officer for a while, just kind of helping with events and doing other activities. So yeah. And then it worked out that because of UMA, I was at a Secular Student Alliance conference, and there I met a AHA staffer that kind of set everything into motion.
Nice. That was your pivotal moment.
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. And so, as I understand, you took some time off to do the Peace Corps?
Yeah, it was during that time I was doing field work. I don't know, I just suddenly felt like I didn't know if I wanted to keep sitting behind a desk, and I felt like I wanted an extreme change of pace. And actually a coworker of mine at the AHA who's no longer here, she had been in the Peace Corps for a while in Africa. And so I talked with her a little bit about it, and I thought that that would be something that I'd be really interested in doing. So I applied for the Peace Corps and I got accepted. So I spent 2 years in the Republic of Cape Verde, which is a little island country that's off the west coast of Senegal.
And what kind of work did you actually do there in Cape Verde?
I was a community development mobilizer. So I was assigned to one of the islands, and I was assigned to a city hall, like in a municipality and kind of like a county, basically. And I was assigned to their city hall, and they actually assigned me to an internet cafe there because internet penetration is only really starting right now in Cape Verde. And, you know, not a lot of people have computers in general, and then definitely very few people have internet access at their home. So kind of having that internet cafe for a lot of people was the one way they could kind of have connection to the outside world and use email or just kind of use MSN Messenger or something like that and talk with friends and have a high five page or whatnot. So I did that, and I did other projects with like little non-governmental organizations that were in my community with dealing with like kids and women's issues and microfinance and whatnot.
Nice. What do you take from that experience, and how did that help you sort of get to where you are now, working for the AHA or in the movement in general?
It's so hard to say. I mean, you know, the Peace Corps is such a great but really challenging experience for me. And I think, I learned a lot about myself and like my limits and doing things that I never thought I could do, you know, immersing myself in another culture, trying to pick up another language and being able to integrate into a community with limited language skills and not knowing a lot about the culture. And so I think in a process like that, you always learn a lot about yourself. And I think that that's definitely helped, you know, shape me. And it was a really, really pivotal moment or pivotal time in my life. And, you know,
let's jump sort of back to the future, if you will, with me. What can our listeners expect? What are some thoughts and some plans that you have for the podcast? What kind of direction do we want to take the show in?
I think I definitely want to build off of what you and Duncan have done in the past. Cause you know, like I said, I've listened to the podcast before and I always appreciated, you know, being able to listen to it and kind of hear all the, you know, interesting stuff that you had going on. So I don't know, I would like to continue, you know, interviewing people, talking with people, kind of hearing their stories and seeing, you know, kind of trying to learn more about the movement, not so much in terms of like just the press releases that we send out or the websites that we have, but you know, the individual stories that people have to share and what it really means to be a humanist, or you know, to be like non-religious or non-theistic kind of in this time in America. Cause it's, I mean, I guess, you know, people every generation always say like, this is a unique time, you know, this is a time where everything's going to change. And I don't necessarily think that that's true. I mean, I feel like for our time right now, there does seem to be some movement toward more acceptance with like the rise of, you know, the SCA and then Barack Obama being elected and, you know, him mentioning non-believers, even though he still does a lot of things like, you know, National Day of Prayer and all that. So right. I'd just be interested in trying to do more to maybe explore like what it means to be a humanist right now in this day and age in America, considering all the kind of different things that are going on.
Right. And also I think we should take advantage of the fact that, you know, we are a membership organization and we have thousands of people across the country who are involved in the movement. So I want to know what they're doing, and I want to know, I mean, what is it like for them to be a humanist in the movement in whatever location that they're in?
Yeah, definitely. Definitely. I think, yeah, with, you know, the AHA has members all over the country and even, you know, a few living in other countries. So I think there's a lot of material there. Or just, there's a lot of stories that I guess that I know can be told.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
Well, Jenda, next month you're coming up to Albany.
Yes, yes.
We'll be co-hosting the show from start to finish.
Definitely. I would be going this month, but unfortunately, AHA National Conference, which I will be hopefully, you know, taping and recording and talking to members and whatnot, I will be there, and it's a little crazy in the office right now. So I think unfortunately this month can't make it, but definitely next month, come June, I'll be able to come to Albany.
Awesome. So you mentioned the conference, and you'll be recording. So if listeners out there would like to attend the conference, is it still possible for them to do so? And if so, how do they register?
Yeah, I believe it is still possible to register two ways. You either go to the AHA website, which is www.americanhumanist.org, and then there'll be a big thing right on there for the conference. It's our 68th annual conference. And it's going to be in Phoenix, Arizona this year. And
awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So it'll be nice. Get some sun out there. So, nice. So you can do that, or else you can call our 1-800 number and speak to someone, and you can sign up over the phone. And our telephone number is 1-800-837-3792. So yeah, those are the two ways, and there's definitely spaces available, and we would love to, you know, see everyone in Phoenix. And ideally I'll be going around with this equipment and talking with people and asking questions and, you know, seeing what they think about humanism, the future of humanism.
Awesome. So go to the conference, hear some awesome speakers, eat some cool food, talk to Jenda, be in our next show, right?
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for sitting with me here, and I look forward to working with you in the future.
Yeah, as do I. I think it'll work out good.
Awesome. Thanks, Jenda.
Thank you.
Stopping me suddenly in my tracks, and I appreciate the facts why I'm here. Yes, I am a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hi, this is Roy Speckhart, the Executive Director of the American Humanist Association. You're listening to Humanist Network News.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. And there you have it, folks. New co-host, Jenda Huang. We're going to welcome him to Albany next month for the June podcast. Next, I'm going to play the interviews that Jenda and I conducted in Washington, D.C. with the rest of the AHA staff. Mind you, we didn't get to interview every single staff member of the American Humanist Association, but we got to a great deal of them, so we're going to learn about what the organization is, maybe how it's a little bit different from the Institute for Humanist Studies. We're going to learn about what each person does, their program, and what's new with their program. And then we're also going to talk on a little bit more of a personal level about each of them and how they got to, you know, not only their place at the AHA, but also how they got involved in the humanist movement in general. So Jenda and I interviewed the staff of the American Humanist Association 2 weeks ago.
This is Jenda Huang, and I'm here at the offices of the American Humanist Association with Karen France, who is the communications and policy manager at the AHA. So, Karen, exactly what is it that you do for the organization?
Well, I handle all of our media outreach and policy work. Any press release that you'd see from the AHA is generally drafted and written by me. Any letter to the editor that you might read in the newspaper or an opinion editorial, I work on getting them out to the media. I'm also in charge of the majority of the policy work that we do at the AHA, and I do a bit of lobbying for the group.
Jennifer Bardi, who is the editor of The Humanist magazine.
So The Humanist is published bimonthly, and typically in any two-month cycle, I'll be reading submissions, working with regular contributors, developing stories. Typically, we like to develop a theme for the issue if we can, and then Mark, the designer, and I work on the cover image. In addition to editing The Humanist, which is the bulk of my job here, I also manage the blog, the Rant and Reason blog. I also try to attend events around town. There are a lot of them. I try to sort of maintain a public presence for the magazine whenever I can.
So listeners, we're here with Maggie Ardiente, Director of Development for the American Humanist Association, and Clayton Witt, who is the Development Assistant for the American Humanist Association.
So I've been the Director of Development for about a year now, started as an intern initially, and some of the programs that we coordinate involve direct mail, planned giving services, major donor support, and a lot of other different things that involve sort of raising money and making sure that the American Humanist Association continues to exist for several years.
And so what's a day in the life of Clayton Witt here like at the AHA? What do you do as a development assistant here working with Maggie?
Well, I do whatever I'm asked. No, but I work a lot on our outreach and fundraising materials. And then, of course, when we get these materials out, I help, you know, organize the responses that come in from members and connect with some of our donors, and also manage the information that we have for our fundraising programs. I do a lot of research on foundations that are potential supporters for the American Humanist Association. And also have the opportunity to write for Free Mind, which is always a lot of fun, and get to contribute a few articles for each edition of Free Mind.
This is Jenda Huang, and I am here with Lindsay Gemberling of the AHA. And Lindsay, I know you have a few titles, I think, for what you do. So exactly what are the three positions that you hold at the AHA?
I have three primary responsibilities at the AHA. The most prevalent of which is probably field coordinator, in which I'm the liaison between the national office here in DC and all of the chapters throughout the US. So I serve as a point person for them. They can contact me for help with recruiting new members to their chapters, mailings, and all of the little details they need in help to grow their chapter. Secondly, I serve as the program coordinator for the Humanist Society, in which I oversee our celebrant program. And a celebrant is someone who enables the conduction of a humanist and non-religious ceremony, such as a wedding, a union, any birthright, etc. And lastly, I serve as the executive assistant to our director at the AHA, Royce Beckhart.
Okay, listeners, we're here with Bob Ritter, who is AHA's legal coordinator of the Abagnani Humanist Legal Center. That's a mouthful, Bob. Tell us what you do.
Hi, thank you. The purpose of the Legal Center here is to ensure the constitutional rights of humanists and religious minorities. In particular, our emphasis is on the area of separation of church and state. This work is done by the Legal Center staff, which is principally me, and on occasion, legal interns, as well as by cooperating attorneys who represent persons who either request assistance or in the case, for example, of an Iowa professor recently, whom I contacted directly and offered assistance of the Legal Center.
All right, listeners, I'm sitting here with my two counterparts, my co-host, Jenda, and my IT counterpart, Patrick Connors, who is the office IT manager, IT office manager. You can choose the order of your preference. But Patrick, tell us a little bit about what you do for AHA.
Well, if it has to do with a computer, or the building, or anything like that, that's under my
purview. So I do it all in a way. yeah, anytime that there's anything to do with a new website, a new domain that we need to put up, virus software, anything computer related, I get the call.
Okay, listeners, so those are some of the names and faces of the American Humanist Association. Now let's dig a little deeper. Let's find out about a little bit more about each of those programs and also about the AHA in general.
There was an article in an international publication that ran today that talked about the American Humanist Association being an activist organization. I think that's a good fit for what we do in that it describes in general, but more specifically, we take on court cases, we have local groups throughout the country, we move through issues in educating young humanists and humanists of all ages. We get out there and actually protest from time to time. We really are trying to turn an organization that originally was more about developing the philosophy of humanism, which we still do, and into much more of an advocate on behalf of humanists and atheists and other folks out there who pick their own labels.
So folks, development, that's what we're talking about. Tell us what's the AHA's sort of take on development? How do you do that? What does it look like? What does it mean to be working in development for the American Humanist Association?
Well, development is all about fundraising, so that means it's all about the money. We're basically in charge of all of the programs that involve raising money for our organization. Right now, we're focused heavily on raising money for different ads that we're placing across the United States. Some of you may have already heard that we put up a billboard in Moscow Pullman, which is actually going to be the first in a series of different billboards that we're going to be putting up. A lot more controversial, something a little more interesting, and hopefully attracting the attention of the media. So that's really our focus this year. And of course, we have so many great programs like the Opignani Humanist Legal Center, our new bioethics center in New York, across the street from the United Nations, and our education center, the CoCHAR Humanist Education Center, which provides educational resources for chapters that want to start children's programs. So those are a few of our main projects, in addition to all of the advocacy work and work we do on Capitol Hill on behalf of humanists. We here at the American Humanist Association are particularly lucky that, you know, we have a really great staff and really great programs that help really move humanism forward. And I think a lot of our members are excited about that.
So exactly what are chapters and affiliates and what do they do?
The American Humanist Association has about 70 chapters and 50 affiliates located in different areas throughout the country. The local affiliates and chapters give the AHA a grassroots presence. Essentially, a chapter is there to provide a sense of community for those people who don't have religious beliefs and are essential in helping to spread humanism throughout the U.S.
So the Opignani Humanist Legal Center isn't so much where any humanist could walk in if they need a lawyer. It's more you guys are operating sort of on a larger scale basis, working on policies and any sort of current event that happens that affects the sort of humanist community as a whole. Is that correct?
Well, that's primarily correct. I mean, I do get phone calls and emails asking for legal assistance. Most of those that we do go forward with are of the variety that I mentioned. For example, both the Christian Cross on the fire tower in Pennsylvania was in response to an inquiry from a humanist in Pennsylvania. But the Mojave Desert Cross, for example, was in response to my research of legal blogs. We are currently working with Mike Newdow to represent more than 250 plaintiffs challenging the federal government's infusion of religion into this past and future presidential inaugural ceremonies. Just yesterday, May 14th, I did have the opportunity of filing an appeal with the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, appealing the case of Newdow versus Roberts, which is the infusion of religion into the 2009, 2013, and 2017 presidential inaugurals.
And can you talk a little bit more about that? How is religion being infused into the inaugurations?
The term infusion of religion is perhaps mine and Mike Newdow's. Specifically, what that means is in the 2009 inaugural, as well as past inaugurals, the Chief Justice of the United States, as oath administrator, has added the words, "So help me God," to the constitutionally prescribed oath of office. We're saying that this violates the Constitution because the Constitution is very specific what the oath of office is for the president. No other oath of office is defined or spelled out in the Constitution itself. So the adding of "So help me God" does add a certain religious flavor to the position of president, which just simply doesn't belong there.
Next, we're going to cover what lies on the horizon for the AHA.
We have a conference just in a few weeks in Tempe, Arizona, June 4th through 7th. And we really encourage folks to come out to that. It's going to be great with Neil deGrasse Tyson, Norma Ramos, Donald Johansson, and many other great speakers. And we also have a March for Science in the works on September 6th here in Washington, D.C., which will be a really good opportunity to coalesce with fellow humanists and secularists and progressivists of all stripes.
I'm going to be managing the e-zine, the Humanist Network News, and going to be working with Ruth Geller, who's the editor of the e-zine. And we're hoping to expand and improve the publication. And we're hoping to include new features such as the movement in the news, things that humanist groups are doing around the country, whether it's something the AHA is doing, something the Center for Inquiry is doing, or a local group such as the Indiana Atheist Bus Campaign. We'd be covering things that they're doing locally there in Bloomington and South Bend.
Starting, it's a kind of a soft date, but starting in September 1st, the AmericanHumanist.org will have a new free online trial membership where you'll be able to log in, have a personal profile, join discussion boards, access full downloadable PDFs of the Humanist magazine, as well as Free Mind, our newsletter. And we're really trying to integrate that with other websites like YouTube, like Facebook. We right now have a Twitter feed that shows up on our site, but you can also subscribe to it and follow us on Twitter as well. And so we're trying to use all that. And those are the type of features that people will be able to start using.
So what's coming up for the next issue of the Humanist magazine?
The theme, as I see it now, is going to kind of be asking this question, has torture become sacred? And why are we not going after some of these high-ranking officials? Are those high offices somehow sacred, and why? So it's a little bit of a play on the secular-sacred dichotomy. But so there's that. And then something that's coming up in August, hopefully, I'm hopefully going to have a chance to interview Gore Vidal, who's the new honorary president of the AHA.
So when's the next issue of The Humanist going to be hitting the newsstands, and where can, like, which newsstands can our listeners go and grab a copy of it?
So the July-August issue will be out mid-June, I'm going to say the 18th, and you can buy it. Borders carries it, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million.
Next, we got a little more personal with each of our coworkers. We learned what brought them to their position at the American Humanist Association, but also what brought them to the humanist movement in general.
I started about 8 years ago now. I had been a member of the AHA, and then I heard that it was moving to Washington, D.C. I thought, why not get involved? And so I did and joined the staff and led to this position.
So you were a humanist before you actually took on your role here. Talk about how you got into humanism, just in your sort of personal life.
Sure. I was raised Catholic and followed that for a while. But when I went to college and I learned more about history and the world around me and realized how inconsistent that was with the religious beliefs I was taught, I looked for something new. I didn't know about humanism, so I tried to create my own thing. I called it progressivism. And in the early days of the internet, I even had progressivism.org where I was putting all this information up there, until in my research, I kept stumbling across this American Humanist Association. I thought, what's this? I guess I better read about it. And so I got, I signed up and got Corliss Lamont's Philosophy of Humanism book and said, geez, I'm recreating the wheel.
Well, actually, I've come from the television production world. I used to make documentaries for a small group. They had a lot of documentaries on PBS, and I worked on a policy-oriented show for them, and realized more and more that I was less interested in the production work and more interested in the policy work. So randomly, one day, I was searching the classifieds and came across an opening at the AHA and did a little bit of research on the group and felt I had that light bulb moment where I realized that I was a humanist, and this is something that I had believed for my entire life, but didn't really have a name for it. And so all of a sudden I had that name and was very on board with the mission of the group and applied for the position, and I got it. Here I am.
So Jennifer, how did you get involved with humanism and the organized humanist movement?
Well, before I took the job, I would say a pretty vague understanding of humanism. I didn't have any awareness of organized humanism. I think I was one of these people who certainly didn't identify myself as a humanist. I was more apt to say that I would consider myself a humanist. I would more often than not say that when I was arguing with someone about religion. But to make a long story short, I mean, I answered an ad in the Washington Post for an editor position. And then before interviewing, I actually read a lot about the AHA. And so, you know, it was one of those, eureka moments where I realized, wow, you know, they're actually espousing kind of exactly what I thought they would, and it makes perfect sense to me. My educational background is actually in the humanities. I mean, I have a BA in comparative literature and an MFA in poetry, but professionally, I come from a science background. So I was doing a lot of editing at a research institute in California before I came here. I was actually there for 11 years and kind of fell into this. My husband got a job at the NIH, so we moved out here from California. And so really, I think writing and editing has always been my bent. And I was lucky to find something where the actual content was something that was important to me.
So what's your background as far as, I mean, obviously you have to have some sort of background in legal works and things like that, but what's your background on the sort of humanist aspect?
Well, that's a fascinating question. I've been an attorney or licensed to practice law since 1988. However, at that time, I was working for the IBM Corporation and didn't leave to practice law. And after leaving IBM, went on to run a family business. It wasn't until after I sold that business in 2000, I started looking for nonprofit jobs, because that's where my desire was at that time, after spending a lot of time in the private sector. But it wasn't until I further got laid off in 2007 that I was very fortunate to see the legal coordinator position open up here at the Appiani Humanist Legal Center. And that fit in very well with my background. I've served on local ACLU boards for over 20 years and have a deep interest in the field of religion law.
So Clayton, you've been quiet so far. I'm interested in how you came to humanism as a movement.
Well, I actually started calling myself a humanist when I was a teenager, and I came around to it from reading Kurt Vonnegut and actually reading The Humanist. And by the way, I'm 27 now, so for a point of reference, reading The Humanist magazine, and I was a member of the American Humanist Association. So I was raised in an unaffiliated household. Neither of my parents were religious. They had both left their religious upbringings, heavily religious upbringings that they left in their adulthood. So I was raised, you know, with humanist values, but not with, you know, any particular religious perspective. And so, yeah, after coming to humanism, after reading the magazine, reading a lot of Vonnegut books and other things, you know, I was a peace activist in college and later joined the Peace Corps, and then found AHA once again when I was looking for work here in Washington, D.C. about a year ago, and was very excited to see that AHA had an opportunity, and was so happy to come in and you know, meet Maggie and Roy and talk to them, and also express my excitement about connecting with an organization that had actually meant a lot to me when I was younger. And it worked out, and I've been here now for nearly a year, but it's been very exciting to be kind of on the inside of organized humanism in the United States, and to see how it all works and actually get to make a contribution towards advancing it.
So Maggie, we've heard about Clayton's
personal history with the humanist movement. Talk a bit about how you got involved with this thing that we call humanism.
That was a great story. I was actually learning a few new things there, so thanks for telling me about that. Well, actually, I've been an atheist for a really long time, probably since I was about 13. You know, just pretty disillusioned with organized religion. I was raised Catholic. But I didn't really become really involved until I was in college. I attended James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and they just formed a new group, and they were called the JMU Freethinkers at the time. And it was very, very small. It was about 6 to 8 people that started up the group. I was so excited about this because my whole freshman year, you know, there were so many groups like Campus Crusade for Christ and, you know, interfaith groups that really excluded people who were atheists and humanists. And so I sort of kept it to myself for an entire year before I discovered this group. And it was a really great group. We grew to easily, you know, several hundred members with the consistent, you know, attendance of about 50 nearing my senior year. And it was fabulous. You know, we implemented things like Darwin Day programs and you know, participated in interfaith panels and made sure that atheism and humanism was represented at JMU. It was really great. And so that's how I initially got involved. I learned about an internship at the American Humanist Association from the Secular Student Alliance. I had attended one of their annual conferences that were based in Washington, D.C. I got to meet Mel Lippman, who was the president at the time. I also got to meet Fred Edwards, who was the editor of The Humanist at the time. And I was hired as an intern for The Humanist magazine for a few months. And when an opening in the development department came up, you know, I was eager to take it because humanism has always meant something to me for the longest time. And it's really the cause for myself. I know a lot of people support things like reproductive rights and peace and end-of-life choices and a lot of progressive issues. But humanism is really near and dear to my heart. And I feel like this is the kind of movement that people now should really get involved in because it's going to start to make a difference. We're really making a difference in Congress and people are actually hearing our voice. And so it's a really great opportunity to be a part of this movement.
How did you personally get involved with humanism? I mean, would you consider yourself a humanist or how did you kind of end up at this position?
Well, at first I didn't really consider myself a humanist, but more and more I would agree with that. I was raised Catholic and had really just been experiencing a lack of inspiration at all of the times that I'd spent going to Mass and Sunday school and in just the spiritual realm of my life. So I kind of wanted to seek something that had, a job that had a set of, you know, secular ideals. And in my quest for that type of job, I came across the American Humanist Association and conveniently they had a position open and it turned out to be a really great fit for me.
Yeah, actually I was raised Episcopalian. My mother has a Master's of Divinity. I was the lead acolyte, altar boy acolyte. So I was teaching people how to hold the cross and light the candles and everything. I think I was 12 or 13 and I was also in the choir. And so I'm sitting in the choir pews listening to the Nicene Creed and just listen to everyone. I've heard it every single week, and it's just something that you say. And the entire congregation was just monotone, saying the thing that they say, like they say every week, because they have to be here every week. And I started questioning what it is that I'm saying. And the Nicene Creed is pretty much the foundation of the Episcopalian faith. It's this is what I believe. And I'm like, I don't believe that. And no, I don't think I believe that. And so I started questioning my belief or questioning what I was raised. And I started realizing that, no, that those are not what I hold. So I stopped going to church and my parents got over it pretty quickly there. I think I was 13 when I stopped going to church. And I, like I said, I was the head acolyte, bass soloist in the choir. So I, stopping everything is pretty big for me, but I was like, this is not for me.
Here are some ways that you can be involved in the AHA.
So how does an aspiring writer get published or become published in The Humanist?
Well, we have an open submission policy, and we do read every submission. We try to get back to writers in a timely manner, which can be anywhere from 2 to 12 weeks. So really, I mean, the best way to get published in the magazine actually is to read it. I think if somebody has a familiarity with the kinds of things that we publish and sort of the tone of the stories and so forth, I think they're going to be in a better position to write something that we might actually be interested in. Certainly, I get queries from writers, from freelancers, you know, and they will pitch a story. And I can kind of decide if it kind of fits in with our calendar.
If someone wants to become a celebrant, what's like the process?
Anyone can become a humanist celebrant as long as they've been a member of the AHA for a year. Once you are and you submit your application, it's reviewed by the Humanist Society. And once you're approved, you can start acting as a celebrant immediately.
Can anyone just find a celebrant from another state, or how does that work if someone really wants someone for a non-religious wedding?
Most of the time, a chapter is in direct correspondence with a celebrant who's located in that state, but you can use a celebrant anywhere. And a lot of the times people have personal connections and people that they know who are celebrants that they'd prefer to use for a ceremony.
So in those cases that you mentioned, those examples that you mentioned for things that you're working on now, are there any way that our e-zine readers and podcast listeners can contribute anything to sort of help you as you're working on these cases?
I'm not sure specifically how the podcast could help, other than informing the humanist community that we are very deeply interested in protecting their interests in the field of separation of church and state. And so that would be how you could help, is really keeping them informed of some of the ongoing activities.
Okay, so if someone out there is listening and they want to become a member of AHA, how do they go about doing that?
You can go to www.americanhumanist.org and you can sign up either as a free online-only member, or you can become a paid member, which helps contribute to the efforts we're doing and growing the humanist movement.
We're going to end with a little bit of a common theme that I saw in a few of the different interviews, and it's addressing a couple of different things. One of them is how there is that group of people who do not identify as a certain religion, but who don't also identify as, you know, an atheist or a free thinker or a humanist. And so there's this struggle to reach these people, to either help them identify as someone who is secular, if they choose to, and to get them to join the movement. And so how do you access that group of people? And once you access them, how do you get them to join in what you're trying to do?
There's been several surveys released in just the last few months regarding religious beliefs in America and how those are changing. And you know, they found that now about 15% of Americans are not affiliated with any religion. And that doesn't mean they're necessarily humanists or even atheists, but I think that the time for outreach and the time to really, really spread humanism in the United States is now. We have tremendous opportunities, and the American Humanist Association is really, you know, looking at all these new opportunities and working to, you know, strengthen humanist outreach and build our ranks and also build humanism as a viable political force in the United States. And it's really happening. It's very exciting. So, but again, you know, these people, these 15% and beyond, aren't automatically going to be humanists, but we can reach out to them and really see this movement grow. So I think that's very exciting.
How do you do that? Like, how do you organize people who don't want to organize?
So I've actually answered this question before by saying that, you know, you have this group of nuns now who are called nuns because they don't subscribe to any religion. And of those nuns who also don't want to join any other kind of organization that might have smack of any sort of, you know, dogmatism or prescriptive philosophy, my answer is, well, you produce a really high quality magazine. You don't necessarily expect these people to show up anywhere, but you do give them some very good stuff to read. I mean, I think with a magazine, I always hoped it would function on several different levels, that for those who already identified as humanists or, you know, were members and were very behind the whole effort and the whole movement, that it would be very sort of satisfying for them. At the same time, I'd like the magazine to stand on its own as just an issue-based magazine that we're covering social issues from a humanist perspective, but that someone could open the magazine and not be bombarded with humanism necessarily, and that they might actually read the magazine and by the end of it say, oh, maybe I'm actually a humanist.
Something that we talked about with Jennifer was it's hard to organize people who don't want to be organized. And so do you see like the work that you do with websites and you know, integrating humanism like on things like YouTube and any sort of social networking site? Does IT play a role in sort of reaching out to those people who maybe otherwise we wouldn't be able to get in touch with?
Absolutely. I think the AHA has predominantly had an older demographic. And one of the things that I really like doing and want to do more is not lose them, but also capture the younger group. With social networking, it's incredibly easy to do because the values that we hold are true for our current demographic and for, you know, kids in high school and kids in college and people who know what they believe in but don't necessarily know that there is a movement. And for people like for myself, I was of that don't need a movement, don't need anything. But when I first found out about humanism, I think in the year 2000, I was like, that sounds pretty cool. But I wasn't going to start any membership for anything. I didn't want to pay anything, didn't necessarily want to meet people with it. But that's changed, not just for myself, but for that kind of age group. With social networking, go to Facebook and you find people who are like, hey, I'm like that. I like that. I can join this group. And it's really easy for people to do that. And nowadays people kind of like showing off what they believe in, what they do.
Well, folks, I hope that you've enjoyed your introduction to the new HNN family. That is the American Humanist Association. I know I certainly enjoyed myself while I was down in DC a few weeks ago interviewing them. And I certainly look forward to working with all of you if you're listening out there. And listeners, make sure that you stay tuned over the next few weeks. We're going to be giving you some more of those technical details about when the HNN e-zine and podcast will be available exclusively at the American Humanist Association website. That is AmericanHumanist.org. So what that means for the podcast listeners and the RSS feed is that this current RSS feed will become strictly an archive feed. So from today's show back through edition number one, that's always going to be available on this podcast feed. But if you, you're going to want to subscribe to the brand new feed. So all the new shows that I'll be doing from here on out with Jenda, those are going to be available on the new feed. And all of our content will be also available on the AmericanHumanist.org website. If you're an AHA member joining us for the first time today, thank you very much and welcome. You can feel free to read up on back issues of the HNN e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. You can also read show notes for and listen to previous podcast episodes at humaniststudies.org/podcast. And once again, folks, don't forget, you can always get in touch with us at hnn@americanhumanist.org. And we'll get you a new listener comment line and a new RSS feed as soon as we have those details for you. So stay tuned. Thanks a lot.
I mean, I just, you know, I always like to say that, you know, we're so grateful for everyone's support of the American Humanist Association, particularly last year when we had the $1 million challenge, where we were actually able to raise $1 million by the end of the year and have a generous gift by Lou Apignani of $1 million matched to our endowment fund. So I want to thank everyone who helped contribute to that campaign. And certainly this is a very important year for people to support humanism. And so, you know, we hope that you like the programs that AHA has been doing. If you have suggestions, please let us know. And we, you know, we hope to see bigger and better things to give to you later this year and next. And we hope you continue supporting us.
Well, Clayton and Maggie, thank you so much for being here with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Bob, thank you so much for talking about what you do and for all of the work that you do, certainly for us. And hopefully one day we will get to figure out what happens when a president doesn't end one of his speeches with, so help me God.
Thank you very much.
Well, Patrick, thanks for being here with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Roy, thanks for sitting and talking with me. I'm sure that our listeners will be hearing from you again in the near future.
Thank you, Jess. Good to be on Humanist Network News.